I think that for me, anxiety is unplanned. Urgency, even though it may be a surprise, tends to move people to a level of planning, a looking for structures, a looking for solutions, a looking for conversation, a movement toward prayer. There is usually a plan of action. Anxiety tends to stop all of that. I mean, it turns on that amygdala, it turns on the chemicals in our bodies that help that tell us to freeze or run. And neither one of those is particularly helpful in a situation that needs to have some sort of resolution.
Welcome to Mindful Leader. This is episode number 8. I am Dennis Shaw. I'm an elder in the Mountain Sky Conference of the United Methodist Church. Mindful Leader is a new podcast where I'm focusing on church leadership. And it's not just church leadership about clergy. I'm focused on both laity and clergy. My guest today is Sarah Calvert. Sarah is the district superintendent for Northern Virginia. And for those of you that, well, I grew up in Northern Virginia in clergy world, and it's what used to be the Arlington and Alexandria districts of the Virginia Conference, but she's now got over 100 churches that are part of the Northern Virginia district. Sarah is a graduate of Mary Washington College. For those of you that are familiar with the University of Virginia system, that was for many years the women's version of the University of Virginia, elite school, very tough to get into. Also, Sarah is a recovering lawyer. One of my best friends is a recovering lawyer. And Sarah is a graduate of the Scalia Law School at George Mason University. She went to Wesley Theological Seminary for both her master's in divinity and her, where I met her, in her doctorate of ministry program. Her project, her thesis there was about clergy support groups. I wonder if those aren't what we perhaps now call circuits, but nonetheless, clergy support groups. She's been active in the local church, and she's also been a district superintendent for 6 years, 5 years?
Fourth year. This is my
fourth year. So welcome to Mindful Leader, Sarah. Good to see you. Thank you for having said yes to my offer.
Yes. Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate it.
Sarah and I have agreed to talk a little bit today on the topic of urgency and anxiety. Urgency and anxiety, and sometimes how do you tell the difference in the two? Urgency can, in my opinion, sometimes be a good thing. Anxiety is rarely a good thing. We always talk about this being a non-anxious presence. Sarah, I threw the topics out, and you went to this one almost immediately. You said that this was one that appealed to you. What was the appeal in it for you?
So when I came in 4 years ago as the district superintendent of just one of the Northern Virginia districts into Arlington, the immediate anxiety in front of us, or urgency, depending on how you look at it, was that we were entering a general conference year, or what was expected to be a general conference year. So I knew I was coming in the middle of a very challenging season for leaders and for the whole church. And so I spent a lot of time preparing to help our churches and our leadership move through a season in which major decisions about what was going to happen to the United Methodist Church were going to be on the plate. How do you, you know, bring that back to your church? How do you protect your church from the, you know, the newspapers that say, you know, schism in the United Methodist Church? How do you walk through that season? And so we spent a lot of time thinking about it, praying about it. And then, of course, it didn't happen. And instead, what we got was a pandemic, which was the urgent of all urgent. In the middle of that, trying to make decisions with little tiny bits of knowledge, or knowledge that turned out to be incorrect. You know, we were preparing for a pandemic that we thought was passed around by touch, and turned out it was passed around in the air as much as anything. We prepared for a pandemic that had one wave, when it instead it had multiple waves and multiple variants going through. And every time we thought we had gotten to a good place, we hadn't. We prepared for the fact that at some point there would be spread within one of our churches, and going to church might kill somebody.
Yeah.
So that kind of urgency and anxiety has been the nature of my entire time as a district superintendent, followed by something that doesn't hit the newspapers very much, but the Boy Scout bankruptcy was tremendously stressful at high levels in the Methodist Church because of the tremendous liability that some of our churches were going to be under. And the fact that, you know, almost all of the conferences and districts had churches with potential claims in that bankruptcy against the potential of the church. And arguing with longtime Boy Scout leaders who told us that we were horrible people for distancing ourselves from the liability as best we could, was for some churches and some places, and mine was one of them, an ongoing chronic issue of anxiety and at times urgency with deadlines from the bankruptcy court. Coming back to a season where we are now preparing for, again, a general conference. So
yeah.
Welcome to Sarah's first 4 years, full of urgency and anxieties and trying to walk my way through them and help my leaders walk their way through it as well.
We've actually been preparing for General Conference 2020 for 4 years, because yes. Next year's General Conference is 2020. It's in,
right,
but in 2024.
Right. And of course, in the middle of this, we changed bishops. And that's been stressful as well. I keep saying I want to be a DS in normal times, and I'm not exactly sure what normal times look like. I've never had that. So
Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
In my very first podcast was with our CFO, our chief financial officer in Mountain Sky, Angela Thomas. And she talked about the stress related to the Boy Scout bankruptcy and the impact it had. It just how draining it was, and how much time it took up. So
tremendous amounts of time.
I want to go to the issue though of urgency and anxiety. People don't walk into the room with the word "I am anxious" tattooed on their forehead. How do you, as a leader, How do you distinguish between a need for increased urgency and that you hear from somebody, as opposed to them being a classical anxious presence? Do you have things that help you out with that?
I think that for me, anxiety is unplanned. Urgency, even though it may be a surprise, tends to move people to a level of planning. A looking for structures, a looking for solutions, a looking for conversation, a movement toward prayer. There is usually a plan of action. Anxiety tends to stop all of that. I mean, it turns on that amygdala, it turns on the chemicals in our bodies that tell us to freeze or run. And neither one of those is particularly helpful in a situation that needs to have some sort of resolution. Anxiety also tends to come in chronic patterns. Urgency doesn't lend itself to chronicness unless you're misinterpreting the signals of urgency. And that does lead to anxiety. But in the sense that we constantly have anxiety. Every time we opened the doors during the pandemic, we worried that something we did would cause the congregation to get sick, or the new choir that came back to be ill, or something we did caused something. So that went on for almost two full years.
Yeah.
And that kind of anxiety lends itself to having to be dealt with on a regular basis. That's not something that just goes away overnight. It needs to be dealt with. It needs to be struggled with, but it needs to have some sort of lessening. You know, people talk about a non-anxious presence, and I always think that is a misnomer. There's no such thing as no anxiety in the room. There's almost always some level of anxiety.
Yeah.
What we need is to be, as leaders, to be the least anxious or the lesser anxious person in the room. So that's as good. Our leadership gathers, as our, you know, as a clergy group gathers, our goal is to go in with the best possible self that we have so that we can help people think through when anxiety has stopped the thinking.
When I went to Salt Lake from Colorado Springs in 2012, right about the time of our graduation from our doctorate ministry program, I asked the district superintendent who was sending me, not where I was, but where I was going, why he thought I would be a good person there at this particular church. And he said, because you're one of the most non-anxious presences I know. And I went, well, one more person I have fooled.
Well, I think internally we all have a level of anxiety that we deal with. And really, it's how we deal with it. And this is something that I have worked really hard to give gifts and training. For me, they're tools. I am not naturally a less anxious person, because I am also creative in that I lay awake at night worrying through things, which is a sign of anxiety, but also looking for solutions. And so that is where I get some of my best solutions, is in the midst of a low level of anxiety. So that for me is helpful, but I have to look to tools. You said something about my doctoral project. My doctoral project was around clergy peer support groups. The title of my dissertation was on how I get by with a little help from my friends. Which is the only Beadle title, as far as I know, in the Wesley doctorate program. But that's just my contribution to Wesley's titles. But it really is. I mean, so many marriages in the clergy world and in church leadership world have foundered on the fact that we bring that anxiety home. We share it with our family, and it's not healthy. But our peers know what we're going through. Our peers have their own levels of anxiety, and meeting in a clergy peer group, be it online or in person or any way, which way we can get it, is usually a much healthier place to take some of these day-to-day anxieties and say, hey, am I crazy that, one of my employees is never showing up for work? Or, is this, do I need to worry if we don't have Christmas planned by November? These kinds of things that clergy need to talk through and need to have a place to do that. And of course, also, I like to make sure that we have as good a program as we can to support the mental health of our pastors, because in many cases, and this happened a lot during pandemic, it went beyond the ability of support and friendship and into the need for substantial medical intervention for some of our folks. And sometimes that just meant some time with a counselor of some kind or medication. But there were some severe problems in some very high stress churches. So that shouldn't be lessened in any way, that we should be constantly aware of how we're providing for that.
Dr. Tom Barlow is on the faculty at Iliff School of Theology, but he was at the local church from 2018 to 2023, somewhere around there. And certainly 2023 is when he went back to Iliff. But his comment was, Dennis, you retired in 2019. I cannot communicate to you the difference of what church was like in 2019 versus 2020. It was just an amazing contrast of, and he said it's, and this was in about 6 months ago, 5 months ago, he said, and it's not back to normal yet.
Yeah, it's very interesting. When I was out in the valley, and I had a mostly elderly church, or a lot of elderly
And
folks.
the valley would be the Shenandoah Valley.
Shenandoah Valley, yeah,
There we go.
near Lorain. And whenever we had church and there was a ice on the roads, I worried that by having church and knowing the faithfulness of so many of our older folks, that I was calling them out to a situation where they were going to fall and break a hip or hurt themselves or be in an accident. So I was very careful about, when I was more apt to call it than they probably, and say, we're not going to have church, it's too dangerous, than probably they were comfortable with, being maybe more inured to ice and snow than I was. But I was thinking of the whole. And when it came to pandemic, we just didn't know. We guessed. And we closed down probably far more than maybe could have been or should have been. And a lot of churches still resent us and hate us. And hate is not too strong a word, for shutting them down during the pandemic when they felt they needed support. But again, how could we call people together knowing that our actions could kill people? And I mean, this was not a minor thing, and this was not a Jesus will protect us no matter what we do thing. I think Jesus called us to be wise and to think it through. But this it's got another feel through it on the anxiety of our system that I believe a lot of our disaffiliations, especially in some of our rural areas that did not, that had a church down the road that had no connection to a bishop or to a cabinet and could just open up whenever they wanted. They saw those churches open and the Methodists who were connectional and had a bishop and a district superintendent were not. And a lot of them said, oh, heck no, I want out. And the 2553 process of disaffiliation has allowed them to not leave because of the issues of 2553 and the issues of human sexuality, but to leave because they're still mad over the pandemic. Yeah. I met with a church that missed the deadlines and will not be able to leave. And the reason they were mad is because of the pandemic. Yeah. She didn't even qualify. That wasn't a reason to leave the Methodist church. But that level of anxiety has just threaded through so much of what we've done. In the last 5 years.
Episode 7, which will be released on the 6th or 7th of August, by the time I give this, it'll have been released on the 6th or 7th of August. Wybra Price is my guest on that. And he addresses that same Book of Discipline paragraph 2553 and about how people departed the Louisiana conference for the wrong reasons.
Right.
And so, yeah.
100%. And the call by some of the misinformation in the system coming from, I dare say, Global Methodist Church and other places was urgency. That was a call for urgency. That has been built on urgency. You must leave now or you will be trapped forever in the United Methodist Church. And then, you know, situations of urgency and anxiety built up.
Yeah.
That's what we experienced every time we went in to do an information meeting was urgency built up around anxiety.
Well, that's where I was going to go. What I thought I just heard you say was that sounds like to me anxiety disguised as urgency under the cloak of urgency.
Exactly. And, you know, we've had 3 years with 2553 with this ability to leave the United Methodist Church that frankly has never existed before since 1968. So, oops, sorry. I do have a dog.
No, worry not.
And but the urgency that is there is an urgency to encourage people to leave, but it's also done with misinformation. Anxiety can come from poor information. And that's something that we, you know, in urgency, one of the most important things we can do is discern what is real in this urgent situation and what is not real.
Cover two things that I think like I heard you mention. One, in either order you want to talk about them. One was tools, and I'll set it up in a second. And the other one was the colleagues. Episode 6 was a pastor at Bozeman United Methodist in Bozeman, Montana, Zach Bechtold, and he talked in his episode about the value of the connection, the colleagues, about how colleagues helped build him up, bolster him up, help support him. So even though he's only been in Bozeman for 1 year, the reality is that the connection helped him in that new situation at levels that many people don't understand. So the beauty of the colleagues, having these colleagues cheering him on, part of the cloud of witnesses. Of course, the cloud of witnesses is often those who've passed away. But in this case, it's a cloud of witnesses that are in this world. They're present in this world.
So let's talk about tools first, because I made some notes about that. I really this is something I have focused on extensively because I've spent so much time in anxious systems, and the work around. You, first of all, the leaders have to know themselves. You have to know what it is that triggers your anxiety. There are certain things that trigger us in different ways. I know that when people talk about whether I'm competent or not, or question my competency, my anxiety immediately rises up. That's a trigger for me. And I think it's well worth the time and the effort to work on yourself enough to know what your own triggers are for anxiety. Because when I am triggered that way, I have trouble thinking well. But now that I do have done more work with myself, and for me, that's with Enneagram and with Strength Finders and some of the other self-awareness tools that are out there, to sit and to know, oh, that comment triggered, you know, this in me, and I can back off because it's a trigger. It's not real. Even if somebody is questioning my competency, I know that I'm competent, and I've done the work to work on that as well. Or that I'm doing the best that I can in the situation I have. So knowing yourself well enough to know your own triggers for anxiety was a really important tool for me. So we have done extensive Strength Finder work within our district so that our pastors know it. And also we've offered it for them to take it to the churches. And we continue to do that work. So that I was coaching one of my folks the other day, and I said, you know, you're going to be fine because one of your strengths is learner. And you know that you're going to go learn what you need to do in order to get through this season. And they took a deep breath and a pause, and they went, I am a learner. I do like to go, you know, but just not being able to get to that thought of what am I good at and what are my strengths was extremely helpful. So that's a big part of how we get through this. My whole dissertation, and I still believe this to this day, is that we don't do ministry alone. When I first came in to ministry, I came in as an associate, which was a huge blessing. I wish more people had the opportunity, but our churches, you know, we just don't have that many large churches, but to be in ministry with another clergy person. And God bless Wayne Sneed. He broke me in and he took care of me. He just retired this year. I was just at his retirement party, but and then from there, he took me to clergy meetings that happened every Monday with large church pastors and their associates. And so I would sit at the associates table. We used to laughingly call it the kids table, although second career people like me were no longer kids. And we would talk about what was going on in the church and what were you planning for and what, you know, what's working, what's not working, what, you know, what are you concerned about? What's the urgency? What are the plans? What are the structures? How do you handle this? That was just the most amazing comfort. And then when I went out to the valley and there were almost no churches around me and I was a solo pastor, I was isolated, and I was a city kid in the country, which is about, you know, even more isolating. Tough. Yeah. And, so it was just a lot to learn. It was my son and I had recently been through a divorce, and it was probably one of the most, loneliest times I've ever had. And so I started getting on Facebook when Facebook was still fairly young, and meeting up with other pastors in Facebook groups, just to have, you know, most of them were friends from before that I would just kind of call back into my circle when I couldn't see them and I couldn't go have lunch with them. I could at least meet them on Facebook. And that turned into the work that I did for my dissertation on bringing people together. And I would drive over a mountain to get to a clergy support group, you know, almost 45 minutes either way, once a week, just to have that kind of accountability and support and challenge. I cannot urge enough that, and I've required it of all of our clergy, that they have someone somewhere. Some of our introverts can only handle one person at a time, but someone somewhere to be there for you to just say, you're going to be all right. Let's think it through. Let's talk about it. Let's take a deep breath. Let's have a meal together. You know, let's go have a beverage together. Let's do what needs to be done to clear those chemicals that get going in the middle of anxiety and get you to a place where you can think something through. And then, as I said, I think that the tools of therapy and medication, for some people, it's going to be absolutely necessary that they take that next step. But I think we are all too reticent to do that.
Yeah.
And we're also reticent to let people like me, your district superintendent, know that that's what you're in the middle of. But it is helpful for me to know that you are taking care of yourself. That's something I try and stress.
Yeah,
but I don't have to know. So
I I'm not sure I know when how I could find it in the sermons I preached in Utah. But I know I talked one day there about the fact that if you break your ankle, we're able to do something about that, either surgically put a rod in there like I did, or put a cast on it, or do things like that, whatever. But somehow when our spirit gets broken, the prevailing culture will sometimes just say, tough it out. Hang in there. And I'm not sure we are aware of the fact that sometimes what helps us, the cast or the surgery that helps us with that, is another person
right.
checking in with us, just telling us that they care about us. They really do.
And I think there's a distinction between mental health and physical health, as you say, but going even deeper into spiritual health, a lot of us neglected our spiritual practices
yep.
that we were trained for in seminary. There's not a seminary that doesn't do this work, and there's not a pastor around who doesn't dismiss it at times when the urgency of the time and the situation. And I saw that in the pandemic as well. So I've taken to asking questions in my one-on-ones that I do every year with my clergy, like, how are you supporting your calling? You know, how are you taking care of your spirit? I mean, they'll tell me about how many miles of running they did, or they'll tell me about how many people they visited. And those are important pieces, but how are you supporting your calling and your faith in God? How are you and God doing the work? Because it's very easy to say at some point, I work for God. I don't have to have a relationship with God. And that's where pastors start to go astray. That's a hard point. And that's the classic pastoral burnout, is to know you have no relationship with God. It was very interesting to me to read some of the biography of her name just went out of my head. The saint in India, Sister
Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa, thank you very much. I could not pull that up. Mother Teresa, when she said that she went like 20 years feeling no connection with God, but that the last she heard from God basically was go and do this work. And so she did. And she just persevered. I think that she probably did not have too many peers around her who were willing to walk with her through that season. But she had her journals and things like that. So that was what she needed. Sometimes some of our folks need a journal, need more prayer time. For me, the hard part for my spiritual work has been contemplation. It's not a gift of mine to sit still more than about 5 minutes. And that was something I really had to work extremely hard on during the pandemic, was to develop that sense of, all right, well, if I can't sit still, then I'll go for a walk. And if I... As a matter of fact, this morning I was at the gym for the first time in a while, unfortunately. And I remember thinking, all right, this is a form of contemplation to, you know,
yes.
And I stopped putting music through my earphones and just kept them dampening the horrific music that the gym plays, and just had some quiet while I'm working, while I'm breathing, while I'm thinking, you know, about I'm in this place now, I'm in this spot now. Which is something I struggle with. I'm always thinking about the next thing.
Well,
not so much about the now.
It's interesting your comment about the physicality issue can lead to a spirituality thing.
Yes.
I'm a recovering marathoner. I developed Lyme disease in 94, so I can't run anymore. My body, my tendons are just too tight, but I was a pretty good runner at one time. And I ran the Boston Marathon in 88, but you run about 60 miles a week to qualify for the Boston Marathon. And, in that pre, iPod, that pre-recording world,
mm-hmm.
A lot of that running time was when it was by myself, which about half of it was by myself. I was running, but I was also mentally doing a lot of self, and I hate to say self-analysis, but I was talking to myself about who I was and what was going on in my life and how I might want to reorder some things, what the priorities were, those kinds of things. Anyway, I just throw that out.
What that does, of course, is burn off those chemicals that take over our amygdala so that we can't think. Mm-hmm. And so for some of us, it is doing physical exercises. For some of it is breath work. For some of us, it is, seeking that deep, deep prayer work.
Yeah.
But you've got to know yourself well enough to know what works for you. You've got to try a lot of things, even into second and third half of life, third part
yeah.
of life.
Yeah.
You've got to consistently go back to what tools work for you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the title of this is Mindful Leader. And part of my supposition by picking that title is that you've got to do some things that work for you. And you and I both are familiar with this book by Linsky and Heifetz called Leadership on the Line. And I don't hear you advocating what's called a technical solution. It's not a cookie cutter. It's not a cookie cutter that one size fits all. You've got to figure out what works for you. But
this is huge. And you've also got to be accountable. And some people are really good at being accountable for themselves, but I take it upon myself as a supervisor of 150 pastors to say, what are you doing? And how are you doing it? And how's it working for you? And do you need to try something else every time I meet with them? You know, because I think it's so important. We cannot do ministry alone. And the time I was raised in, you know, when I first came out of seminary, and we were sending out mailers for our Christmas mailer, and the pastor down the street got irate that some of our mailers wound up in, you know, inside of his zip code, he felt. And I remember that argument going on between the pastors of you know, how horrible this was that you have come into my area. And I thought, that's just craziness. You know, what difference does it make? We need to be connectional. If they're going to a church of any kind, hallelujah, go to the Catholic church down the street. Go to the other Methodist church or this Methodist church. But that whole kind of I'm the Lone Ranger and this is my spot is kind of taking John Wesley out of turn, you know, that this is, you know, the world is my parish. That's lovely, but you're connected to each other as part of that world-making, world-transforming kind of ministry that we can have. Very interesting thing coming out of pandemic to watch is how few of my pastors are not currently in some kind of cooperative work. I'm actually checking in on it this season as I started my meetings. I've done about 25 of my 150 and I've got surveys back from about 50 of my pastors at this point. And one of the questions I asked was, are you doing cooperative ministry with anyone, any other church? And it used to be, I'm having coffee with the pastor down the street. Now it's, we're doing a whole summer VBS program together, or we're doing youth programs together, or we've done children's, or we've swapped choirs, or we've swapped pulpits. The cooperative work that comes out of the connectionalism that is currently almost imposed on us by the fact that we all had to check in with each other over the pandemic has been a tremendous benefit for the United Methodist Church. And for those that will stick with the United Methodist Church, I think it's the great gift of the next stage of whatever comes in Methodism. There are so many unchurched people today, and I was just reading an article about this morning, that I am convinced that there are plenty of people for us to find and for to find us, that we need not compete with each other or other denominations even. Just meet the people that we're supposed to meet and disciple the people we're supposed to disciple. And that's the work that God puts before the church.
And that's a matter of urgency, not anxiety.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't know that it's a matter of urgency. This is something that I'm always interested in about when you talk about something that's urgent. You know, I remember the first time that our treasurer came to us and said, we must urgently file these documents for the Boy Scouts, in order to be in the bankruptcy system. And it needed to be done in a very quick and timely manner. And so you deal with the urgency when you're in the middle of it. But then you also look back, and this is the piece that gets missed time and time and time and time again. You look back on that urgency and you say, what could we have done to make this easier? What could we have done to make this more efficient? What could we have done to make this less of an urgency and more of a, okay, just here's a plan for how we deal with this. And so the next time something, you know, like this happens, let's have a plan. Let's think it through. So urgency gives you a gift of retrospect, But that feedback loop sometimes just doesn't get closed. And so we find ourselves dealing with urgencies time and time and time again. This is that poor worship leader who doesn't know what the sermon series is and is constantly trying to figure out what the music should be, because there's constantly an urgent change or a lack of communication. The closing of the loop to say, okay, we've got to plan things out. We've got to have a way of thinking through how we do our worship in cycles and in series and in looking ahead. That urgency goes away. And that urgency has potentially a cure, or at least a structure around it.
Yeah. In Salt Lake at Sandy, where I was a pastor at Hilltop, my music director and I would basically most Mondays we would have a cup of coffee and we would talk for about 30, 45 minutes over the coming 6 to 8 weeks. Part of it, she's picking anthems out today for what we're going to sing in 6 to 8 weeks. And she wanted to have a clue as to where I was going with all of that. Plus she was so fundamentally theologically rich that the conversation I would have with her would find its way back into my proclamation in some kind of way, whether it was liturgy, whether it was the sermon, whether it was the pastoral prayer, it would find its way back. So
the other gift of urgency, I think that needs to be said is that urgency brings our awareness to things that we are not currently aware of.
Yeah.
And sometimes this is, I'm thinking of like the George Floyd incident and things that raised up our awareness and made us go, oh my gosh, this happens all the time. Now we see it. And especially for those of us that were not in a community that was regularly being abused by the police, our knowledge of it was minimal or it was extrapolated and we just didn't see it. That kind of urgency, I believe comes from God. I believe that God calls things to our attention in an urgent way at times. And I think there's a Franciscan prayer. I have it. I'll read it to you if you want. But sure. That basically talks about may we be uncomfortable, and may we be the kind of people who are made uncomfortable. This is a Franciscan blessing that I very often use in worship and when we're doing worship with our clergy. May God bless us with discomfort at easy answers, half-truths, and superficial relationships so that we may live from deep within our hearts. May God bless us with anger at injustice, oppression, and exploitations of God's creation so that we may work for justice, freedom, and peace. May God bless us with tears to shed for those who suffer pain, rejection, hunger, and war, so that we may reach our hands to comfort them and turn their pain to joy. And may God bless us with just enough foolishness to believe that we can make a difference in the world, so that we can do what others claim cannot be done, to bring justice and kindness to all our children and to our neighbors who are poor.
That's good.
That's a Franciscan blessing that I've seen before.
And I will see if I can find that and I'll put that in the show notes.
It's called a Franciscan blessing. I don't think it's of St. Francis or anything, but nor is St. Francis's prayer from St. Francis, but that's all right. In their tradition, apparently.
Could be part of the order or something the order does.
Yeah, maybe their liturgies or something. Yeah. But I maybe we'd be blessed with discomfort and urgency and even anxiety at times that force us to think through the paths that we thought were so comfortable, the life that we have that is so privileged, and to remind us to be grateful. I think those are all the gifts of both urgency and anxiety if it's handled well.
There is one of the elements of anxiety, I think, is that anxiety is often happens when change is needed. So change, it's the anti-change vaccine. and so, of course, we need to be careful about that. Sometimes change just for the sake of change is stupid. But sometimes the organization does need to change. Gil Rendell, I think it's the Metrics of Mission, I think it's the title of the book, he uses it, but he says, we don't know what to do, so we do what we know. We don't know what to do, so we do what we know. I think sometimes anxiety comes up from the fact that that we want to keep returning to, we want to return to what we know, even though the world may be a little different now. So I almost feel like this is sort of part one of a conversation you and I will pick back up in a couple of months. So I sort of make this invitation to you. If I invite you to come back on in a couple of months, could you find some time with your working with your 150 clergy to give me another hour of your time?
Yep, I'll be on renewal leave, which I have struggled to take from Thanksgiving to Christmas.
I'll get you before then.
You can get me there before then. It'll just be a little harder. Monday mornings are usually good for me. I save that for my planning and structure time. So,
well, normally I ask people we're telling everybody we're going to come back to you later. But is there any piece of parting wisdom that you want to offer at least for this end of this episode before I say goodbye, or are we okay?
No, I think one thing that needs to be said is that the work that I do needs to be contagious, and I can't say and do things that are not mine. So I tell all of my clergy that, look, I'm taking renewal leave. I take all 4 weeks of my vacation. I take a Sabbath. And if I can't take a Sabbath, then I take an extra Sabbath the next week. I stay on top of the need for refreshment
self-care
and renewal and self-care. And I expect them to do the same, because the piece that gets lost is anxiety is constantly being brought into our church communities by the families that are part of our church communities, by the people that come. And if we can't model for them as leaders of a church the fact that we are people who take the ability, take the privilege that we have for vacation, take the time to pray, take the time to do the work. If people don't see us and know us as people who are working on our anxiety, then they have no model for and no framework for what church can offer them in the way of lessened anxiety in this world. And then no way a discernment of what is truly urgent versus what is just frightening. Which is often disguises itself as urgency. So I think that the work has to come from my level of leadership, and it needs to go to the pastors, and it needs to go to the laity. And so the work we do is constantly mitigating anxiety. Information reduces anxiety. So my job is to provide information and information, and also a model for people to say, oh, well, we know pastor takes her vacation, and we know, she takes her Sabbath, and she'll call you back in, 24 hours if you call her on her Sabbath day. So just modeling that for people, instead of thinking that working for God requires that you throw out God's Sabbath and throw out God's rest and recreation, is really, really important. It infuses our entire community and makes it healthier if we do it right.
Well, Adam Hamilton back in the early 2000s made a comment that one of the demonic forces that works so hard against the church is our saying one thing and doing something else.
Exactly.
So I hear you sort of on this issue of know yourself and take care of yourself, and don't just talk about it, walk it. Is that a fair statement?
I think that is fair.
Okay. I want to say thank you to you, Sarah, for having said yes to this. So we'll come back to you again before you go off on renewal leave. And my plan would be to ask you to be on here once or twice a year. So hopefully we'll come back to different topics on different things. Although this one, I think we could come back to this one again and do some more.
Hey, we've got a general conference coming. Heaven only knows what our urgent and anxious thoughts will be.
Amen to that.
All right.
Thank you to everybody who had a chance to listen today. I'm going to try to get into mode where I do this, release these every 2 weeks. That's going to be my goal. And I've got one already. This is now my second one that I'll be working on, get it out there. It would be best for you if you could get this onto your the means by which you listen to podcasts. I personally use Overcast. That's where you can find it. But you can also find mine on Apple. The iTunes is where it's also there. And there's various levels. If you have trouble finding it on your podcast server, send me a note at at Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S, at Mantuan, M-A-N-T-U-A-N.org. And I'll have that address in the show notes. Sarah, thank you very much again. God bless you. And I look forward to talking to you another day. Peace be with you.
Thank you, Dennis. God bless.